Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 27th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Albany Gastroenterology Consultants, board-certified gastroenterologists now offering artificial intelligence-assisted colonoscopy screenings, working to help improve early detection rates and outcomes. AlbanyGI.com. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. David Perlmutter, an ophthalmologist with Perlmutter Eye Center in Albany on Clifton Park. Dr. Perlmutter specializes in cataract surgery, glaucoma treatment, and retinal diseases. He performs laser and surgical treatment of cataracts and glaucoma. He performs laser and intravitreal injections to treat medical diseases of the retina. If you have a question, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and in the studio today, Dr. David Perlmutter, a board-certified ophthalmologist who joined his father and other great doctors in practice in 2015 at Perlmutter Eye Center in Albany at Clifton Park. He also has affiliations with Albany Med, St. Peter's, and Wills Eye Hospital. Dr. Perlmutter specializes in customized cataract surgery, glaucoma treatment, and retinal diseases. He performs laser and surgical treatment of cataracts and glaucoma, and he performs laser and intravitreal injections to treat medical diseases of the retina. For 3 years running now, Dr. Perlmutter has been ranked by Newsweek magazine as one of the top 150 ophthalmologists in the U.S. A pleasure to welcome him back to the program. You have a question, give us a call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Perlmutter, welcome back. Happy holidays.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. Before you explain all of the trickiness of intravitreal injections, it's a phrase I like to say now, that's literally putting a needle in the eye, right?
Yes, it is.
Doesn't that make you as a doctor nervous?
Thankfully not. It's something that we do quite frequently. And, you know, when you're in training, you practice these things before you ever do them, you know, on a real life patient.
You know, one of those things that you grow up and you have misconceptions about how things work. And I always thought if you put a needle in an eye, it's going to pop.
Thankfully, the eye can hold additional fluid compared to its regular shape. And so while you can't put an unlimited amount of volume of fluid into an eye, you can inject medication into an eye in smaller quantities and smaller volumes without the eye having too much trouble.
So at what point and with what illnesses or conditions would you be pumping fluid into an eye?
The most common reasons to inject medication into an eye are macular degeneration, diabetic diseases of the retina, and blood vessel blockages such as a branch or a retinal vein occlusion or a central retinal vein occlusion inside the eye.
You know, it's so funny you bring up diabetes. We did a diabetes show last week on the show. And it's funny to me, not funny, but it's odd that sometimes people don't know they have diabetes until they go to the eye doctor. What happens in the eye when you have advanced diabetes?
So there are a couple different things that can happen, but it all comes from the circulation inside the eye. So diabetes over years and years affects the circulation throughout the body, and the smaller blood vessels inside the eye also get affected. And so as the circulation is affected inside the eye can do a couple different things. One is you can start to get some swelling in the retina. And we're talking about a structure that's less than a third of a millimeter thick. So when I say swelling, it's nothing that patients feel. It's nothing that they really know is going on, apart from sometimes noticing that they're not seeing as clearly. And this microscopic swelling that occurs in the retina can cause damage to the tissue and affect the vision permanently if it's not addressed. Another thing that happens with diabetes is when the circulation gets, you know, very poor inside the eye will actually attempt to grow new blood vessels. And it sounds like it would be a good thing because the blood vessels that are there are damaged.
Yeah.
But it's sort of a good idea that goes wrong. And so those blood vessels, they grow in places they shouldn't grow. and they're very fragile, so they can bleed and cause blood accumulation inside the eye, or they grow with a little bit of tissue that can pull on things, and they can tug on places inside the eye that they shouldn't be tugging.
Dr. David Perlmutter is our guest today, and we will take your calls momentarily. 800-348-2551 is the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. The reason I brought that example up, I did know somebody who, no idea they were diabetic, went to the eye doctor. This person's eyesight started getting real terrible. Like you couldn't see stop signs and things like that. And the doc said, yeah, I think you better go to the doctor and check this out. But when this person was on medication, and it wasn't insulin shots, it was metformin or something like that, after a couple of weeks, the eyes cleared up and he could see again.
So that person probably had some swelling of the lens inside the eye. So when the blood sugar becomes elevated, if it becomes highly, extremely elevated, then the lens inside the eye swells a little bit. When the lens swells, it changes the type of prescription that a person might have to clear their vision.
Oh.
So they may notice changes in their vision. And thankfully, when the blood sugar gets under better control, that swelling goes down, and then it often goes back to where they were before.
Interesting. All right, let's grab an email or two here that came in well before the show. This came in early this morning. That's how excited people are to have you on this show, Dr. Perlmutter. This is from... don't know the name. They never sign their names. I have a choroidal nevus that was first identified by an optometrist about 5 years ago. I now follow with a retina specialist for annual exams. The retina specialist, I see, says that they are unable to see the nevus with their retina camera because their lens isn't wide enough. The doctor also performs a B-scan ultrasound and says that the nevus is unchanged and not concerning. My question is, should I find a practice that has a retina camera with a lens that is wide enough to visualize my nevus before you start? What's a nevus?
So a nevus is a medical word for a freckle. So anywhere there is pigment in our body, we can get a freckle. So most people are familiar with freckles that develop on the skin because of pigment cells under the skin. But there are pigment cells underneath the retina in the choroid, and those pigment cells can form freckles as well. So like most freckles on the skin, most freckles underneath the retina are harmless, although typically we recommend having them monitored because occasionally a freckle can transition from a harmless freckle to a non-harmless entity. Now, as far as the question about how to appropriately monitor a choroidal nevus, usually some are can have more concerning features than others in terms of how closely we want to monitor them. But we monitor them with ultrasound, which is the B scan, and that looks at the thickness of the freckle. With photos that you can track over time, which is the retinal camera that's mentioned in the question. And then also by examining the eye and actually looking at visualizing the freckle with our examination equipment. Really, as far as whether you should be seeing a different doctor, I think you'd want to have a conversation with your doctor about whether they feel comfortable with monitoring that freckle with the equipment that they have. If it's a very, very benign looking freckle and it's very, very low risk and they feel comfortable examining it with their equipment and just looking at it once a year, that could be reasonable. If it were a higher risk freckle where photos would be helpful, then, maybe they'd feel more comfortable with a camera that can capture a good image of that freckle.
Now, I've never seen a retinal camera before, but have you ever heard of a patient saying, okay, you can't view this because the lens of your retinal camera isn't wide enough? I mean, the retina is very small. You don't need a big lens, do you?
Yeah, there's a field of view within the retinal camera. Most things that we deal with, if we're talking about, like we said earlier, about swelling from diabetes, that happens right in the center part of the retina. Typically, in any retinal camera, we'll be able to capture that. But there are certain things that happen in the perimeter areas of the retina. And for that, there's a special type of camera that's called wide field imaging. And there are different companies that make these cameras, but they utilize different lens technology to take more of a zoomed out image that can see farther out in the peripheral areas of the retina.
Gotcha.
So there are specific cameras that can image that. Whether or not that's necessary in this case, I would have that conversation with your doctor.
All right, this email from Paul, then we'll take a break, then we'll hit the phones. Dr. David Perlmutter joins us today. 3 years in a row, he's been ranked as one of the top 150 ophthalmologists in the U.S. by Newsweek magazine. Paul writes, Paul is in Bel Air, New York. Last year, I had a detached retina in my left eye. Doctors fixed it in one hospital operation. At the end, he injected gas, and eventually that dissipated. This year, I had detached retina in the other eye, and he injected oil. My question is, once he removes the oil, should my vision be clearer? Right now, it's blurry.
So that's a good question. It's definitely harder to see through oil inside the eye than it would be through the natural medium of the eye, which is the vitreous gel. Or if someone has had retinal surgery, instead of the vitreous gel, there's more of just a water-based media inside the eye. And so it's definitely harder to see through oil. But whether or not the vision is going to improve once the oil is out, it really depends on what happened with the retinal detachment. So with retinal detachments, if the detachment goes through the central areas of the vision, then the likelihood of maintaining good vision in the eye in the long term goes down substantially. So that's something that you would want to ask your doctor is regarding, you know, what the retinal detachment was like in the beginning and what to expect after the oil comes out. But the answer to that is, you know, unfortunately, I can't tell you without knowing the history of what happened before you had the surgery.
So the retinal detachment, does that require trauma or can it just happen on its own?
It can happen to anyone, anytime. So the way I explain it to patients is that the retina is like wallpaper and it lines the inside cavity of the eye in the back. And then the eye is filled with this sticky gel substance. And when you're born, that gel is stuck to the retina, to the wallpaper in the back. And at some point in your lifetime, that gel will start to release itself or lift off from the retina.
And why?
So there's aging changes that happen in the gel itself. It becomes a little bit more liquid versus more of a gel substance.
Mm-hmm.
And as that happens, you know, the composition changes, and so it starts to lose its attachment to the retina. And typically when that happens, people notice a floater or sometimes a couple floaters in the vision, and that can be a sign that the gel just released, but nothing bad necessarily happened. But sometimes as that gel releases, it also tugs on the retina somewhere, and it can tug and tear the retina. And if you get a tear in that wallpaper, water can sneak in through the tear and track underneath the wallpaper, and that's a retinal detachment.
Gotcha. Let's take a quick break here. Dr. David Perlmutter joins us. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. We'll be hitting the phones momentarily. Oh, that's a lot of underwriting. Zach, the engineer, how long did it take you to cut that one? A few minutes, I imagine, huh? His whole life. Now, I wish you were on mic, sir. That's Zach Malloy, our engineer over there on the other side of the glass. 800-348-2551 is the number. Dr. David Perlmutter is here, and let's jump to the phones, and we'll begin in LaGrangeville, I believe. Patrick, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Oh, this is Patrick. Anyway, so one lighter-hearted question, which will be real quick, and one regular question. Anyway, it's like my grandmother always told me I was blind in one eye and couldn't see out of the other. Any notions on that?
probably would need a little more detail on that one.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's an old
An
old saying.
And it sounds like an expensive problem for a doctor to deal with. So
Right. So anyway, I recently had cataract surgery, and I'm very happy with the eye center that's taking care of my stuff here. So I guess a general question is that one eye seems better than the other when it has come to the replacement lens, and then they put in a lens which appears to be like, you know, one of them is a 2.1 lens and one is a 2.0 lens. But how long really is the healing process for cataract?
So that's a good question, Patrick. What I say to most of my patients is that most people have very usable vision after cataract surgery within a few days, sometimes a little sooner than that, sometimes a little later than that. But that's a generalization. If you're talking about, you know, when is the vision, you know, when is the fate sealed of the vision and it's time to get new glasses if you need them, that's usually between 4 and 6 weeks afterwards.
Mm.
But there are other things that
so
can...
So again, so yeah. Say if I have a little, it looks like I almost have a tear, looking at it, let's say I almost have a tear ready to form in my eye. Is that something normal with that retina or with the healing process?
Well, it depends if you're talking about something in your vision or more of the feeling that there's liquid on the outside of the eye. So a common thing that happens after cataract surgery is sometimes the surface of your eye takes a little more time to heal and get perfectly comfortable. And if the outside surface of your eye is a little irritated or a little dry, sometimes from the medicines you've been using after surgery or sometimes just from the incision itself, the eye might want to water. It may want to water to keep itself lubricated and wet. So you may just be feeling the outside of the eye having a little irritation.
All right, Patrick, thank you so much for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. What do they make the cataract lenses out of?
Most commonly, they're made out of an acrylic material, and it's a flexible material so that the lens can go through a small opening. So the lens goes into the eye, the artificial lens goes into the eye, folded up like a little taco, and that way it can go through a very small opening, and then once it's inside the eye, it unfolds into a larger lens.
And how do you know you have it perfectly in place?
So we use an operating microscope to do the surgery, so we can see everything that's happening inside the eye with a lot of magnification and three-dimensional view of everything.
I'd heard tell that at some point, some people who have cataract replacement will need it not shaved but sort of cleaned off once, just once, and then after that it's fine?
Yep. So if you think of the natural lens of the eye being like an M&M, there's the candy shell, and then there's the chocolate, the peanut, or the pretzel, or whatever kind of M&M you have in the middle there.
Sounds delicious.
It does sound it. And so what we do with the surgery is we make an opening in the shell, take the chocolate and the peanut out, and then we put the new artificial lens right back into that shell, and that shell that was holding the original cataract in place now holds the artificial lens in place. The back of that shell sometimes will get a little cloudy film on it over the course of either months or years. And if it gets enough of that film to affect how well a person is seeing or cause other symptoms like glare at night, then we use a laser and we clean that film off.
Is that a fairly straightforward procedure?
Yeah, it can be done in the office. Some people do it at a surgical center if that's where the laser is available. But it's a very quick and easy outpatient procedure.
Dr. David Perlmutter joins us today. It's Medical Monday. 800-348-2551, the number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. To Newburgh we go. Fletcher, you're on.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, thanks. I am going to have cataract surgery in another month or two, and I was given an option between laser surgery or a traditional scalpel surgery. The first one costs a lot more, and the other one doesn't cost anything except for insurance. What is the difference as far as the doctor is concerned? Is there more success or with a laser than there is with a scalpel? Is there a longer recovery time? Why should I pay more money for laser-assisted surgery than scalpel surgery if everything else is equal?
I like it.
What do you think, Doc? That's a great question. So the FDA approval for – it's the femtosecond laser that you're talking about. For the femtosecond laser with cataract surgery is for management of astigmatism. And that really has to do with how well you see after surgery without correction, meaning without glasses or contact lenses. So – the use of the laser is, if I'm using it for surgery, it's to decrease someone's astigmatism so that they have sharper vision without glasses on after surgery. From a safety standpoint, there's no data that using the laser is safer than manual surgery if you have a good surgeon with a low complication rate.
Yep. Okay. So there is no difference in the recovery time? For me?
Not when you look at large-scale data, no.
All right.
No, okay. And the doctors are also as comfortable doing it with a scalpel or a laser. Is it help the surgeon in the procedure itself?
So that's something that you'd want to ask the surgeon. There may be a specific reason if they recommended it for you. But in general, if you think of cataract surgery as being, about an 8 to 10-step process, the laser does a few of the opening steps, but whether you use that laser for that opening step or not, you still have to go in with instruments and ultrasound energy to liquefy and remove the lens, and then you still have to put the new lens in. So some of the steps are the same regardless of whether it's done with a laser or manually. But as far as whether there's a specific reason that the surgeon may have preferred it or recommended it, that's definitely a question you want to ask that surgeon.
Fletcher, thanks a lot. Are there doctors, are the older doctors that you know in this area in the entire, everyone who does this sort of thing, are the older doctors more skittish about using lasers, or are they on board with this?
I think it depends where the doctor does their surgery and whether the laser's available.
Yeah.
Because there's no, when you look at large-scale data, because there's no clear safety benefit to doing the laser, and we have pretty good, the laser's been out for a while, so we have pretty good data on this. Not every center has a laser present, and therefore not every doctor even offers it as an option.
How long have they been even doing these cataract replacements?
The cataract surgery itself? Or
yeah.
The...
No, not laser. I'm talking about the old-fashioned way. It can't be that long, right?
Well, the old-fashioned way was to go inside the eye with a really small needle and to poke the lens of the eye out of the way.
Yikes.
And once it fell out of the way, it's still inside the eye. But if it's not blocking the vision, then you can... You know, give someone very, very thick glasses to make up for the fact that they don't have a lens anymore.
When did they stop doing that?
That's a good question. I'm not sure, but
did you ever do one?
A long time ago. No, that's that was more in the days of the Renaissance.
Right, leeches and whatnot. Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. Dr. David Perlmutter's our guest. Judy in Kingston, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling. I recently had cataract surgery, and before I had the cataract surgery, my doctor told me that I would notice my floaters more after the surgery, and I do. I definitely do. Now, one of the things he described to me that could be done about this was to replace, this is the way I understood it, was to replace the vitreous in my eyeball with saline. You would suck out all the floaters and everything and replace it. Is that something that's done commonly, and how long has that procedure been around?
So the name of that procedure is a vitrectomy, and the vitreous gel is a strandy, sticky substance. And so the procedure involves going inside the eye and cutting and sucking out that gel. And then as that's happening, it's being replaced with saline, as you mentioned. So floaters aren't harmful. As long as nothing else has happened when someone has gotten floaters, like a retinal tear or a retinal detachment, the floater itself doesn't hurt anything inside the eye. So it doesn't have to be addressed unless it bothers someone a lot. Typically most docs will say that you should really feel like you're highly, highly symptomatic from those floaters, and they're bugging you a lot to have an elective surgery that you don't necessarily have to have in order to address them. But some people will get, a big floater that's right in the center of their vision, and they're having trouble seeing a computer screen or doing something that's important to them, whether it's work or driving or something else. And so some people do choose to have surgery for it, but that's pretty... it's definitely much, much less common than most people who just see those floaters less and less over time.
All right, Judy, thanks a lot. Let's go to Albany, and Mario, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a lot of allergic symptoms due to MS condition, and a lot of it is in the eye that I was diagnosed with allergic conjunctivitis. And my ophthalmologist used to prescribe me steroids. Recently, I saw an allergist at Albany Med, a colleague, and he said, forget about steroids, which I knew was not good practice, and take Romolin, which has I use it every day as needed. I also use Romolin for the nose spray, which is over the counter, and that seems to be taking care of my symptoms. What I want to know... how often can I use Cromolyn eye drops? Because I'm using it every day, and now everything is frozen, so allergies are a little bit better. But spring, summer, fall, it's pretty bad for me. So I need to use it every day, basically.
Yeah, Cromolyn is a common medicine that's been around for a long time over the counter. And, if you're using it daily, there's no major effects that you need to be concerned about. But you also just want to wonder why you would have those allergies that regularly through the whole year. So if you're seeing an allergist, you might want to try to pinpoint what it is that you're allergic to. And if you can avoid that, then you can use less medicine on the eye.
Mario.
It's side effects of MS. My neurologist advised me not to do allergy testing or take because it's loading your body with protein.
Okay.
And
go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's
and so immunosuppressive drugs, my immune is relatively suppressed, so it's not a good idea to load it up with excess protein.
Yeah, that makes sense. You definitely want to consult with your neurologist and your allergist before going ahead with any kind of plan.
All right, Mario, go ahead. You finish up.
Yeah, but Cromolyn over-the-counter is nothing worrisome in terms of long-term use.
Mario, thanks for the call. It's Medical Monday today with Dr. David Perlmutter, a board-certified ophthalmologist who joined his father in practice in 2015 at Perlmutter Eye Center. How's Dad doing?
Oh, he's great.
Yeah? Oh, good. So you're the young doc among the more mature doctors there, yeah?
Yeah, that's a nice way to say it.
Do they treat you like a child?
It is interesting. Some patients, because I grew up in the area, I've known for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
I have friends I grew up with and their parents come in or, neighbors and family members. So,
yeah. Yep. All right. Now there's that kid again. Let's go to Jim in Schenectady. Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just had cataract surgery, the beginning of November. And I've been taking prednisolone, I think that's how you say it, ever since. And I'm kind of worried about that. Is that a standard procedure to take that for, several weeks or months after cataract surgery?
So, Jim, every surgeon has a different regimen for the drops after surgery. Prednisolone is a common medicine to use. It's a steroid, so it's anti-inflammatory, which helps with inflammation after the surgery. And depending on the surgeon, they may want it, four times a day or, twice a day. And there might be a different schedule as the month goes on.
Right.
And it all depends on whether some people just need drops longer after surgery than others. So some people, inflammation goes away quickly. Yeah. And in others, it can be a longer process.
Yeah. Okay. But that can do damage to your eye, right? After a while, it can cause other cataracts or other problems.
Well, the two big, big issues with steroids are it can make a cataract form sooner than it would have otherwise, which once you've already had cataract surgery, you don't have to worry about that. The other thing is that steroids can make eye pressure go up in a small subset of people. So if you're on steroids for a longer period of time, it's good to make sure your eye pressure is being monitored so that it doesn't go up.
Right, right. Okay. And also, I had 20/20 vision after the surgery, and then a week later it was down to 20/25, and I'm still going to need glasses, I guess, for that eye. Is that odd for that to happen, or is that because I've been wearing my old glasses kind of affected the vision maybe and changed it?
No, wearing the old glasses doesn't hurt your eye or change the outcome. There are a lot of reasons that the vision could be different at that point compared to what it was before. Sometimes it's just, not the final outcome. Other times there could be something else going on. Yeah, so that's important if you're not seeing as well to talk to your doc.
All right, Jim, thank you very much. 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday with Dr. David Perlmutter. Let's grab one more here before our next break. 800-348-2551 to Mechanicville. Ray, nice name. You're on.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering how quickly a cataract matures or ripens, going from mild to something that would be operable. That's one question. And the other one, is there always a need for reading glasses after cataract surgery?
Okay. So, Ray, question number one. That all depends on the person. So the cataract is the lens inside the eyeball getting cloudier as you get older. And at some point along the way, it gets cloudy enough that, you start to notice symptoms. But whether you notice symptoms depends on what you do. So if you drive at 4 a.m. every day and you're going to notice some glare from headlights or difficulty driving in the dark sooner than someone who never goes out past 5 o'clock. And then also, it depends on what else you like to do and what you do with your vision. So that's one part is, each person, you can have two people who have the same amount of clouding of the lens inside the eye, and one person may feel symptomatic and want to have surgery for it, and the other person may not. And then also, it's not just about the lens getting cloudy in general, but it also matters where it gets cloudy, whether or not it causes symptoms. So sometimes people will have a little bit of clouding that's way off in the corner of the lens, and it may not cause a lot in the way of symptoms. Other people may have a little clouding that just sort of sneaks into the middle of the lens, and then right when it gets to the middle of the lens, all of a sudden they have a lot of symptoms. So there's no real one-time course for a person in terms of how fast it will change on you. And so it really matters where the lens is getting cloudy and what you do with your eyes.
What about the reading glasses?
So there's a lot of technology for the artificial lenses that can go inside the eye with cataract surgery. And depending on the person, there are lenses that can allow people to have less need for glasses altogether, both for distance and for closer vision. Not everyone is a good candidate for those lenses, so that's something that's important to talk to your doctor about.
Why would some person not be a good candidate for that? Sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, it's very convenient, but those lenses do have potential downsides to them. You know, certain lenses can, some people can have increased risk of glare or halos around lights at night with a lens. And then also the way that the optics of the lens works, if there are other eye conditions that are causing issues, sometimes things can actually be worse, not better.
Okay, Ray, you want to follow up?
Are both types of lenses that you just talked about, or the range of them, are they all covered by Medicare?
No. So Medicare covers what's called a monofocal lens. And it's true for all insurance. It's not just Medicare. And the monofocal lens is a lens that does not correct any astigmatism, and it's set for one focus point. That focus point could be a close vision focus point, if that's what a person prefers, or it could be a distance focus point, if that's what the person prefers. Whichever one you choose, the person still needs glasses for the others. And if the person has astigmatism, then the monofocal lens doesn't correct that, and then the person would still need correction for even if it's distance or near.
What do most people choose?
Frankly, it depends on the financial situation. You know, it's because there's an out-of-pocket cost, and it's not necessarily a health issue. People choose differently depending on how they value that.
That's diplomatic. 800-348-2551. We are joined today by Dr. David Perlmutter. It's a Medical Monday. We'll be back. Horace Silver, there's pretty eyes. Horace Silver, you know, when I picked this music, it's weeks in advance. I didn't even know we were doing an eye show. That's pretty clever, right, Doc?
That is. That's perfect.
The number here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. One email here, and then we'll jump back to the phones. This is from Sue. Anything new on the treatment of dry macular degeneration? I already take a REDS and have had my prescription changed accordingly in regard to my changing vision. And that's from Sue.
Sue, that's a really good question. There are a lot of commercials now because there are some other treatments that are available. So traditionally, we think of macular degeneration as being either dry or wet. And the dry macular degeneration most commonly happens where people get aging deposits underneath their retina. And over time, with enough of those deposits, it damages the retinal tissue and affects how well the person sees. Some people have these deposits and never notice any issues with their vision, but you know, with enough of them, it can become a problem. And then other people would progress to what's called wet macular degeneration, which is where, in addition to those deposits and some of that tissue damage, they get swelling or bleeding that can rapidly deteriorate the vision and cause scarring in the retina. So going back over a year ago, all we had available were injections for wet macular degeneration to try to control that fluid or bleeding to prevent that rapid visual decline. And we didn't have anything great for dry macular degeneration. People would take the AREDS2 vitamin formula if they had moderate to advanced dry macular, and that did decrease the risk of developing wet macular degeneration, but it didn't reverse or slow down any of the slow deterioration that people get from dry macular. Now we have two medications that are out that are FDA approved, and those two medications are injected into the eye. They are indicated for what's called geographic atrophy in dry macular degeneration. And geographic atrophy is an advanced form of dry macular where a person starts to develop patches of tissue loss. And those patches of tissue loss often affect function, and they can progress and get larger over time. Injecting these medications into the eye slows down the expansion and the progression of that geographic atrophy, those patches of tissue loss. It doesn't reverse anything, and it has to be done in the office regularly, but it is nice to have options because, as you can imagine, the more tissue loss that you get in that center area, towards that center area of your vision, the more debilitating it can be.
I've seen a lot of commercials with Henry Winkler talking about just this, and he says, hey, once you get this, it cannot be cured, so stop it early.
Correct.
Dr. David Perlmutter joins us. Henry Winkler, alas, is not on the show with us today. Let's go to Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
When looking at a distant object and seeing a shadow or ghost, is that a sign of astigmatism?
Jim, it could be a sign of many different things. It means that you don't see very clearly out of that particular eye if you're talking about just with one eye. And so it could be a very, very long list of issues, you know, running from something as simple as glasses to other more significant issues inside the eye.
Maybe you just saw a ghost, Jim. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Steve in Glenville. Steve, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. Several years ago, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and I've noticed my vision getting worse and some double vision. My question is that Parkinson's related? And if so, who would treat that? My Parkinson's neurologist or the ophthalmologist?
So, Steve, with Parkinson's, there are a few different things that can happen, you know, that are common. One of the most common things is that people tend not to blink as much, and the eyes get dried out on the outside, and that can affect the vision and typically causes intermittent blurring or sometimes, you know, tearing and watering of the eyes, and can be helped with over-the-counter lubrication eye drops. But double vision is a big category of potential things that can occur with an eye, and it really depends on whether that double vision is being generated from both eyes to only when they're working together, or whether it's, you know, coming from one eye on its own. That's something you definitely want to see an ophthalmologist about, because depending on why your vision isn't as good, and we're still not, you know, even addressing all the other possibilities of things that can cause decreased vision for a person, which, you know, sometimes when we have a condition like Parkinson's, we want to think that it's always going to be related, but it could be anything that's unrelated too. So it's definitely worth just making sure you have a full eye exam to look for what could be going on.
Steve.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. And let's go to Kingston. Allison, you're on.
Yay. This is my first time calling a radio show.
Welcome.
And I'm very excited. Thank you. I love your show, Ray. I love Vox Pop.
Thank you.
It's so informative, and you're so funny. And now here's my question.
Okay. All right.
Eye disease runs in my family. I'm 71, and so they've all gotten everything, macular cataracts, and the third one, which I can't remember. So far I'm clear, but I do have dry eyes. I saw something, and they're tired sometimes. So on the internet at this company where I bought things before, they sell an item that you put over your eyes, and it's warm, and it lightly massages your eyes. Is that... could that be harmful?
Well, Allison, you don't want to put anything on your eyes that's going to put a lot of pressure on them. But at the same time, we often will have people do warm compresses and gentle massage with warm compresses on their eyelids to help with dry eyes. And that's because there are these little oil glands in your eyelids, and we all have them, and there's lots of them. And their job is to release oil onto your eyeball all day long to keep it lubricated. And sometimes they just don't work quite as well as we want them to. And then the eye gets a little bit dried out. So that warm heat helps to melt, liquefy the oil, and massaging the lid helps to push that oil out of those oil glands to keep them working well.
All right.
Okay, so as long as it's not a lot of pressure, it could be beneficial.
Yeah, it could be helpful. It kind of depends on how well this device works. But you can also achieve the same thing with a hot compress that you buy at one of the big box stores and you put in the microwave.
All right, Allison, thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate you making the leap to calling this program. Did you just say there's oil that goes on your eyes? I thought when you teared up, it was basically saline solution.
So there are three different parts to your tear film. There's a mucus layer that sits on the eyeball itself. It's made by cells that are in the skin that covers the white part of the eye. And then there's the saline, which is made by your tear glands. And then there's an oil layer that sits on top, and it locks and traps that moisture in for you. And that oil layer is made by those oil glands in the eyelids.
Interesting. Never knew that. This email from Charlotte. I use eye drops for redness daily and wonder, is that a safe thing to do? An email. That's not on the phone.
Okay. Charlotte, depends on what kind of eye drops. The over-the-counter redness relievers that are like the Visine, Clear Eyes, those types of redness relievers, they usually work temporarily, and then after a good hour or two, they wear off. And if you're using it regularly, then when it wears off, you get rebound, and it actually ends up worse.
Ah.
So there's an over-the-counter medicine called Lumify, which is longer lasting and doesn't have the same rebound effects, which can be used regularly. But the other ones make you worse off, not better.
We're joined by Dr. David Perlmutter today, and let's go back to our phone lines. Anna is in Pittsfield. Anna, you're on.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
One second. I had a fall, and it didn't catch it right away, and I had a small tear on my retina, and they say that it migrated over the macula, and I was operated on to do what they called, I guess, a peel of it, I guess, and they replaced the lens, but let's see, quite shortly after this, I fell again, and so I'm not sure whether it just never really, you know, I never got my vision back really after that. I mean, I have vision, but it's just a kind of a central fog a little bit. Anyway, and I was wondering whether that could, you know, be operated on again, or I don't know.
Okay. You've mentioned a few different terms which are important. One is a retinal tear, and so retinal tears can lead towards retinal detachments. You also mentioned the word peeling something, which sometimes we get little membranes on our retina that can affect the clarity of the vision and then can be surgically peeled off. But it, you know, it's hard for me with those different terms. Now, they're not all related, but if you did have a tear that then sort of progressed into a retinal detachment, where the detachment involved the macula, which is, the macula is just the name for the center part of your retina, right in the center of your vision. So if you did have a retinal detachment that went through the center of your vision, the likelihood of having the same level of vision afterwards that you had before the surgery is, you know, is not good. But it sounds like you don't quite have you might want to ask the doc, you know, for a little more explanation as to exactly what was done, so that you can fully, you know, understand it. And never hurts to get another opinion if you're not sure and you want to have, you know, ask those same questions. But it's hard to say without looking at an eye and having the exact history.
Anna, thank you very much for the call. We'll head to North Bergen, New Jersey. And Barbara, you're on.
Yes, thank you so much, Ray. And Dr. Perlmutter, the thing that I'm calling about, I actually have a couple of questions.
Okay.
I was recently diagnosed in the summer with something called narrow angle, and the concern for potential sudden onset blindness was the reason that the doctor recommended that I get laser iridotomy in both eyes. And I did do that, and I was just wondering if I do have at night, I hadn't noticed it before that. There was no change in my vision at all, except for, I guess, now I don't have to worry about the pressure building up my eye and sudden onset blindness, which is wonderful. But I do notice at night that there's a little bit, if you will, white noise, a peripheral vision, that there's some light. So I'm wondering, is there, when you locate the iridotomy on the iris, is there a better place to locate that so that it might reduce that?
So Barbara, there's some theory behind it. I can't tell you with, strong data as to whether or not that's the case, but typically we locate the iridotomies, in towards the nose or out towards your temple. And the thought process behind it is that sometimes the light ray can sneak in through the hole that we make in the iris if it's way off in the corner, and give someone like a little ghosting or a side image or something like that. And so there's a thought that by locating it temporal or nasal, that it may reduce the instance of that. And there's also some theories as to why that happens. Some people think that it's because the liquid that's right on the edge of the eyelid margin can bend light a little bit or refract light and cause that. So we typically try not to locate the hole right at the edge of where the eyelid meets the eye. So to answer your question, we do certain things that we think reduce the risk of that.
What is an iridotomy?
Okay.
Yeah, so an iridotomy is a small hole in the iris, the colored part of the eye, that we make with a laser. And we do it because in some people, the space inside the eye where the drainage network lives is tight and small. And that laser helps prevent that drainage area from getting completely closed off. If that drainage area does get closed off, then the fluid continues to get made from inside the eye, but that fluid can't leave the eye through a drainage pathway And the pressure can build up very rapidly inside the eye and cause severe vision issues.
All right. Well, we lost Barbara there, but I think Barbara must have gotten most of that. So thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. Let's now head to Malta, New York. And David, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Hi, doctor. I had a question. Within the past 10 days or so, I've been diagnosed with I believe it's called a vitreous hemorrhage in one of my eyes. And they've done two or three looks at the eye with sophisticated instruments that you folks have in the practices these days. And they noticed potentially a pooling of blood and potentially a tear in the retina. And I wondered, they're now discussing options for surgery, potentially, I guess, laser surgery. But I guess I'm wondering what sort of not diagnosis necessarily, but what sort of remedies might be available to me in terms of this? And is it possible to retain vision in an eye where you have a slight retinal tear?
It's a couple questions there, but the blood that you get inside the eye, when you get a retinal tear, there's little blood vessels in the retina. So when the retina tears, often a blood vessel will break and release blood into the cavity of the eye, into the vitreous gel. And that blood is then floating around inside the eye. Retinal tears definitely should be treated with laser to seal the area around the tear so that it doesn't progress into a retinal detachment. It's challenging, though, if there's a lot of blood in the eye, because to do a laser in the office, you have to be able to visualize the tear, and sometimes you can't see the tear through the blood. So the ultrasound equipment helps to look for a tear or a retinal detachment that might be behind some blood if the doctor can't see through the blood with the regular office equipment. So if they've identified a tear in the retina, but they can't see the tear and they can't see it well enough to do laser on it inside the office, then often a doctor will offer surgery to go inside the eye, clean the blood out so that they can then visualize the tear and safely laser it.
All right, David, thanks for the call. We'll have to wrap it up here. Dr. David Perlmutter, how do people find your shop online?
It's perlleye.com, or just Googling, Perlmutter Eye Center.
Okay.
And we have offices in Albany, Clifton Park, and as of May last year, we have an office in Troy as well.
Guess I better put that on the script for next time. Thanks for reminding me. Hey, David, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Support comes from Dr. John Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Once again, thanks to Dr. David Perlmutter. And, it's an interesting show. I learn a lot to be paranoid about every time he's on. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Amber Sickles, who answered the calls today. Amber, thank you. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we will metaphorically head outdoors with Jeremy Hurst and Angelina Ross of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you then.